Hello and welcome to the Growth Workshop podcast with your hosts, me, Matt Best and Johnny Adams. In this podcast, we'll be sharing insights from our combined 30 plus years experience and hearing from other industry leaders to get their thoughts and perspectives on what growth looks like in modern business. We'll cover all aspects of leadership, sales, account development and customer success, alongside other critical elements required to build an effective growth engine for your business. This podcast is aimed at leaders from exec all the way down to line managers.
We're thrilled to have Will Fraser join us today for the conversation. So Will has a successful international and club rugby career in rugby union, playing for Saracens and winning many trophies along the way. Will retired back in 2017 and since then has been building out a professional services consultancy firm focused on creating effective culture within your business. So as is customary at the top of all of our podcasts, I'd like to kick us off really by welcoming Johnny and as ever as my co-host. Ooh. And Will Fraser to the conversation. And hello. As is customary, Johnny, what's been good in your week?
What's been good? I finally kicked myself up the arse and had been completing my chartership in managing consultancy. What was interesting though, it asked me a question about what am I going to do to continue my own personal development. And it did prompt the thinking, which I think is always important. I don't know about both of you. Actually, what are you going to do to continue to grow and develop yourself? And I've committed to completing a coaching course by the end of the year. The reason for that is that I do an awful lot of coaching, but I'm a firm believer that learning the theoretical understanding and the frameworks that sit around something is really helpful to when becoming more proficient in something. So there we go. That's what I've been doing. Getting myself moving, thinking about what I need to do by the end of the year, and I'm going to commit to doing a professional coaching course.
Blimey, that's a longer list than we normally have, Johnny. Thank you. and Will, welcome. Thanks so much for taking the time and chatting to Johnny and I today. What's gone on in your world this week?
Firstly, thank you for having me. Secondly, my interesting thing is a lot less professional than Johnny's. Knowing Johnny, I wasn't expecting to come out with something so prim and proper and personal development, growthy. My week, so there's a show in the West End that's been based on my younger brother. He wrote a book and the book got adapted to a musical. So I went to see that and it was quite a nice connection of two important bits of my life because I went to see the show and the Saracens squad, the team I used to play for, the current squad, all went to see it as well. So that was a really cool evening out for me to have these two parts of my life connected together, which was cool. So completely opposite to Johnny's. Listeners can decide which one's more interesting and more fun.
I have to say the show is absolutely outstanding. It brings a tear to your eye and it's a wonderful story to share some of the history that's gone on for Henry and your family.
It's been unbelievable. It's very surreal to watch a significant moment of your family's life played out on stage. It was played back to you and it's and the whole family, me, obviously the connection to my older brother with Johnny, they were doing uni together. So someone's playing Tom, someone's playing me and my youngest brother Dom. And yeah, it's unbelievably surreal and the uptake of it has been phenomenal. It's very cool. Very cool.
Gosh, yeah. I think that trumps any introduction, to be honest.
I hope it at least trumps Johnny's. If it didn't trump committing to a coaching course, then the show would be terrible.
We should have covered this before. I would have.
Yeah, I'm glad you went first, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Setting the bar nice and low. I'm probably going to come in even lower than that. So I think in my last week, what's been quite exciting, and again, fairly work-related, much like you, Johnny, is kicking off a coaching program with a group of clients. And actually, I think, and loosely tying this to your share there, Will, is just encouraging people to reflect back. It's so interesting when I guess you're forced to reflect back and look at somebody else playing out a really critical point in your life. But it's a lot of what we do is helping people in taking a step out of themselves almost and being able to look around and see what's going on and maybe put themselves in other people's shoes. Yeah. Slightly tenuous link there, but yeah, that's it's always
a link nonetheless, right? Program.
A link nonetheless. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks so much for joining us today. As I've already said, as someone who's emerged out of this successful sporting career into a business context, we'd imagine that there are some real parallels between those two environments for you. And today we're really looking forward to exploring those with you. And our listeners are going to want to learn from your experience and how culture can support their business and personal growth. It'd be a great place to start, perhaps, just to understand a bit more about what prompted you to start 101st.
Yes, the team I played for is probably one of the most successful English club sides in English rugby history. And it all happened in a relatively short space of time when you look back. So we had this 10, 15-year stretch where, you know, the club have won, I think, 6 or 7 Premiership titles, 3 European Cups, produced a handful of international players, of which I wasn't one. I appreciate you're interested in Sasha. It was England days, you know. You could say it's international or something.
Did you wear the red rose?
I did. As they say in the show, it was England B that anyone can do, but AO. And to be honest with you, that experience of being part of that environment is entirely moulded my worldview when it comes to teams and how you build them, and entirely morphed my mind into why I'm doing what I'm doing now. So the premise of that success, obviously, you have very talented people who are very good at rugby, but the premise of that success is actually was built away from the pitch. And it was almost this focus on, right, how do you get the right people in the room with shared goals, a higher purpose, shared values, all the stuff that we see on LinkedIn every single day. And it almost becomes so generic now. But actually doing it is very different. And then living it is very different again. So I was really fortunate that I got to be part of a group who genuinely was so bought into that. And it was such a focus. And then we got, the rugby was the byproduct of it. So really, when I look at that journey and what the club did in getting to that point, fundamentally, that's what we're looking to help teams with through 101st. We're very honest and transparent with what we do. And the first thing we say to any client or potential client is there is nothing we can do to directly make you better at what you do. Right? I've never done your job. I've never worked in your organization. It'll be unbelievably management consultative of me to pretend that I could make you better directly at what you do. What we do, your job's irrelevant to what we're looking at. What we do is everything before the job. We're looking at you as a group of people. How do we get you as a group of people to function as well as you possibly can together? And if we do that, then what happens as a consequence is you become better at your job because you're more emotionally connected to one another. You understand the value of what you're doing into the end goal of what the business does. You can have better conversations. We can be objective. We can challenge. We can, all these sorts of things that are irrelevant to the specifics of a job and what a sector does. It's specific to a group of people. And that's really what we did as a club. So the two are very intrinsically linked in terms of taking what I experienced. And it's all not just anecdotal. It's very much backed up by data, by research. And you look at any kind of sustainably successful, when we talk about sustainable, we mean over long periods of time. The only commonality between sustainably successful teams is actually the connectivity of the people within them and the structural cohesion, the social cohesion that comes as a result of that. So what we do is we look at, well, how do we help implement that with teams, yeah, across all sectors.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And just building on that, well, and you shared a lot already there, but I'm curious to understand where you start with something like that. You talked about not coming in and trying to help people in changing and developing skills, which actually is a lot of what Johnny and I will do with our clients, where we bring in best practice and many decades of collective experience to drive that. But I'd love to understand where you start with a business. So let's say a business decides, yeah, 101st, this is what we need. And we talk a lot about culture on this podcast, right? And I think the culture is clearly a big part of this. But where do you start?
So the reality is we don't do the specifics of the job because people like you do that. So thankfully, we don't need to, right? But the reality is people come to us when there's a challenge and when there's a crisis. So when something's happening within the business, because the thing with, again, culture is one of these words that is just so overused, I think, and people don't really actually understand what it is. And culture to one group is completely different to the culture to another group. And I think that by definition is culture, right? It's very specific to the group of people that are intertwined within it. And the reality of it is that we don't know whether the culture's good or bad until something happens, because life just goes on, work just goes on. So there needs to be this kind of circuit break that forces you to stop and think. And that circuit break within businesses is usually some form of crisis, some form of challenge, adversity, a strategic decision, a change in leadership. But something happens. And it's when that thing happens is then when we get brought in. Because it's then, how do we manage this? And in the managing of it is when you unearth, okay, we can't manage this until we actually know who we are as a group to begin with. Because until we know that, whatever plan we come up with, we're not bought into and we're not giving it everything we can, because there's all these questions in the back of the head that we haven't answered. What do we stand for? Actually, do we think the same thing? Do you think the same thing about the company values that I think about the company values? And we did operate off these like myths and assumptions that because we all work for the same company, we all think the same thing. So the reality is the complete opposite. And so if we don't know that it's a complete opposite, then we're never fully going to be able to deal with whatever it is we're dealing with, because we're operating on completely different levels without knowing that. So we miss all these kind of percentage points within it. So going back to your question, our starting point is usually something happens within a business. And the reality is as well, because we don't look at the job, we look at people. So fundamentally, the funnel of problems that we get presented with is so wide. The solution is so tight because it comes back to people. Even if you're a sole trader fixing a computer, you still got to buy that computer from someone else. So everything comes back to people somewhere down the track. So for example, we had a client come to us, their kind of global board level, say, oh, we're really bad at giving each other feedback. We want to work on feedback. And you go, okay, that's fine. Now we can set that up. But the reality is feedback can only go so far if you don't fundamentally know each other. If there's not an environment where you can actually give objective feedback and know it's going to be taken objectively because the intent is right, we're all trying to get after the same thing, it doesn't matter how many coaching sessions you do with feedback, there's only so far it will take you. So what we need to go down to is actually the cohesion of the group and understand how well do we actually know each other to enable an environment that will allow for feedback to be given and received and that kind of stuff.
I'm curious because Matt and I, when preparing for this session, we were really super curious about what you do from conceptual to a contextual perspective. Could you describe, you don't have to use client names, but could you describe like what that actually looks like when you deliver the outcome, maybe something from a tangible perspective, because it's great to hear how you're delivering against that
challenge. So I think how we deliver is probably the most kind of unique bit about what we do. So our tagline is using the power of incredible real life experiences to drive change. So again, I make no bones about the fact that I am the most underqualified person in this entire industry. I used to chuck a ball around for a living. That's I'm not, but
quite well, but only in Glenay.
Yeah. It's subjective. Yeah, my dad tells me I was quite good. So
no, your dad's all your rubbish because we know your dad.
Yeah. So in terms of what we do, so the premise of that is the reality of how we're wired is we rely on stories. Right, that's how even to the dawn of mankind, if you were a hunter-gatherer, you went to a river to go get some food and there was a lion on the riverbank, the way you told your tribe to not go to that riverbank is telling the story of when you went to that riverbank and you saw a lion there. So storytelling is in our DNA and we need evidence, like we need a hook. So if we're going to go in and talk to teams and tell them that actually to create long-term sustainable success, essentially you've got to spend time with each other, you've got to get to know each other, build connectivity, all this sort of stuff. If we can tell people that till we're blue in the face. If we have nothing to evidence it and nothing to get the juices flowing, there's no business. Like, no one's buying that. So what we do is we use an incredible real life experience in that field. So for example, using that example of cohesion, we later have a number of people we work with who have incredible real life experiences, from Henry, my brother, to his life-changing accident, through to people that have built and scaled million-pound businesses, through to people that work in sports psychology and everything in between. And what we do is we're understanding what the fundamental challenge of the client is. So forget the job, forget what they do. What is the fundamental challenge? The fundamental challenge here is actually we need to get to know each other better. Okay, cool. So let's bring in sports psychologists who talks using sport as incredible life experience and actually busting all the myths and assumptions we have around performance. We assume this gives us performance, but actually it doesn't. We assume it sits. And using sport as an example, using data, using research, showing that when you look at every successful sports team, whether it's basketball, whether it's football, whether it's rugby, the only thing they have in common is that their cohesion data is through the roof comparative to every other team. And cohesion data is essentially how long have they spent playing, doing the job together, and how many people within that team have been internally promoted or produced through their system. Now, so David will come in, he'll do his bit, it's an hour and a half. Then what we do is go, okay, cool, we've got all the juices flowing, we've got some epic stories and it's super interesting. Essentially, let's now take David out of this, let's take all the teams we heard out of this, and let's take the frameworks, the language, the research, the data we've heard, reframe, repackage, reapply it into your context to help you build cohesion within your team. And that's then what we do as 101st. We frame it as we've all been to company conferences and industry-wide conferences, wherever it is, and an inspirational speaker comes along and they're awesome. And you go home, you talk to your partner, your friends, your family, you go, Matt, you were amazing, like this, that, and the other. We go to bed, wake up the next morning, nothing changes. We just go straight back to what we did the day before. But by definition, there's an inspirational person there who has so much content that we can use, but we don't use it. So what we're saying is we're going to use it. We're going to be that bridge. So how do we take all the good stuff we've heard and make it relevant to the challenge, the specific challenge or crisis or change that you're going through? And then we then are that bridge. So we then facilitate that and do all the follow-on and all that kind of stuff.
When you talk about the sporting context here, and we use sporting examples a lot when we're talking to clients, right? We know they're fairly compelling. And in a lot of cases, sport is thought leading in these sorts of areas. And Johnny and I were talking the other day just around what businesses look like if they were a sport team. And there are some businesses where if you translated that into a match, they wouldn't even be on the same pitch, let alone passing the ball in the right direction. And it's bringing those businesses or bringing those groups or those teams together. And I think when you talk about what culture is, that's a big part of it, right? That sort of collaboration. And like you say, is how it's about how people engage with one another. What I'm really curious to understand is you talk about that growing up together through a business. I know in lots of sports teams, it's the you can predict a sports team's success based on what their junior teams are looking at, the shape of their junior teams. But in sport and in business, it's quite hard to retain that structure, those people, continue to motivate those people in that way. What's the advice that you would give to your clients around either a new business that's quite young that doesn't have that depth, or a business that's maybe gone through lots of changes and hasn't got a really strong basis or foundation? Yeah.
So I think the first thing is there needs to be real, like, deliberate intent to go down this route. So we talk to our clients a lot around, if you're going to build teams or view teams this way, it's a philosophical choice because it's going to take time. And by saying philosophical, what you're saying is like, this is an emotional thing, like we're in this, we're going down this track. But then that's backed up by the research. So as I said before, every bit of research out there in this space tells us that actually the longer you can keep people together, so you build structure cohesion. So the longer you can keep people together, what you get out of the back end of that is social cohesion. And that's where you get the performance benefits, because you build transactive memory, tacit learning, you understand each other. And we know that successful teams aren't built on what people know and what they can do. It's built on the connection between a group of people and how quickly can you problem solve and how honest and objective can you be that someone's ballsed up, as opposed to just blindly not saying anything, knowing there's an error, and then 6 months later, oh yeah, I thought that wasn't right. Why didn't you say anything? These things that happen every single day in teams and we don't appreciate. And performance is based on myths, right? So you're trying to bust those myths. And go to your point, I think it's hard and you can't really give advice because it's entirely nuanced and dependent on the group. But what I'd say is, there's a guy called Alex Pendleton who's done loads of research in space, and it's quite categorical. Every organization has a natural rate of churn. However big or small, there's a natural rate of churn because families are going to change, people's dynamics and financial situations are going to change, have kids or whatever it is. So that's naturally going to happen. He says it's mental that we add to that, that we deliberately and intentionally add to that already natural rate of churn when we know that changing people is one of the biggest things that hampers performance. So again, there's this myth of the portability of talent. So we can go to market, we can buy the most skilled person, and that's the person that's going to change us, turn us around. And that never happens, or very rarely happens, because talent is encased in a group of people, right? So the only reason that I was a relatively good rugby player is because I was in an amazing team. I'm not actually individually that good of a rugby player, but because I was in a system that allowed me to flourish, that allowed me to do the things that I was good at, that the perception was that I was all right. And I think when we think about teams in that way, it's changing how we view the makeup of a team. If we fundamentally change how we view the makeup of a team, then philosophically that changes how we then manage teams and how we build teams and how we build for the future. So if we build teams as independent units of skill, the incentive is to go and buy the best independent unit of skill. So therefore, if someone doesn't hit a certain ridiculous metric that's essentially been plucked out of thin air, we get rid of them and we bring someone else in who invariably doesn't hit the same made up metrics. So we go to them and we just have this kind of, until we do it 10 times, someone comes in and performs really well. And that one time out of the 10 is what we then base the rest of our decision making off of. Oh yeah, we work with this person, so we'll work with everyone else. When the reality is the complete opposite. Football is a great example, right? Statistically, the best thing that can happen to a football club is having a transfer ban put on it, statistically. It forces you to work with what you've got. And you don't, because the football is run on this myth that you can just go to market, buy the best. How many players do we see in Europe, on the continent, are the best players in their team, best players in the world, they come over to a Premiership club and they flop. We assume it's that person, right? We assume it's something happened on the flight on the way over. But the reality is they're in a brand new system with brand new people. Some won't even speak the language. They've moved their family across into a different country. They're in new schools. Their partners don't know anyone. Talent is encased in a system. It's so much wider than that person, yet we focus it. There's a thing called fundamental attribution error, which says that we attribute to individual what can be best explained by context. So when someone comes over and underperforming, it's unlikely to be them. What is more likely to be is the context of their situation. They say there's research out there that it says it takes up to 3 months to learn the language of a business. Right, 3 months just to know what the hell people are talking about.
Yeah.
In the corporate world, what's the typical probation period for someone starting a new job? 3 months. I now know what all these crazy letters mean and the acronyms, but I've not got the job. So it's crazy. So we're judging people on complete myths and complete assumptions.
I'm going to challenge you slightly. And the reason why I'm curious to get your thoughts on this is that you mentioned a minute ago around the transfer ban, and the best thing that could happen is a transfer ban. I get the context of what you're sharing there is the people side and building the image. However, as human beings, we have a ceiling of proficiency that we can get to. Effectively, yeah. When we're born, we are able to build our intelligence in our early years. We then form our personalities. And then what we start to do is form our behaviors. We have a threshold that we can get to. If we put a transfer ban on a business, okay, and we were not recruiting the talent that would take us from 20 million to 50 million, that would potentially not enable growth. So there must be something else we must have with people, and we must enable some talent that needs to come to the team to carry on flourishing.
No, you're not. You're absolutely right. So the transfer ban example, because the transfer ban is for a set period of time. So that's for 6 months, a year, whatever it is. So we're not saying a lifetime transfer ban. Yeah. So that's for a set period of time. So that's why you see these spikes, because all of a sudden for 6 months, people just have to get to know each other. Now, what football then does is rather than understand that and supplement with the right people, it then just overhauls everything. But you take Chelsea as a prime example. So Lampard comes in during a transfer ban. They finish fourth. Great result for him as a first major club. Great result for Chelsea at the time. Transfer ban gets lifted. He spends £300 million on players, gets sacked. Greg Potter comes in, spends another £300 million on players, loses 10 games in a row, gets sacked. It's just the model. But to your point in businesses, so going back to this natural churn, what the natural churn allows you to do is supplement the existing people you've got. So if someone's naturally leaving for whatever reason it is.
20% churn that we typically see being researched.
This is it.
Per year, we can replenish that with
this is it.
To take us from,
And the question is, what is the person you're bringing in? That's the recruitment side of them, because what are you recruiting against? Are you recruiting against metrics and these made up things, or are you recruiting someone that's actually going to fit into the system?
And I guess that comes on to the question I've been kicking around as well, which is we deliver to approximately 50 clients a year. We deliver sales transformation, enablement, and training and coaching. And I've reflected on the last 5 years and thought, what are some of the things that make programs work and programs not work? And actually a client said this, a prospect said this to me a couple of years ago. I thought it was one of the best questions. Tell me why programs fail. I was like, that's such a great question. And I feel like one of the top three things, if not one of the top things, is the fact that businesses and their approach to development and the leadership approach to development stinks. My opinion is that leaders don't believe that professional development is a really important part towards a business's culture and a business's plan for the year. If you had a group of individuals that had the inward perception of the fact that development isn't that good, but actually they say outwardly to the business, I believe in development. Is there anything that you would recommend that the people need to change to really buy into development?
I think you're absolutely bang on, by the way. And we see that all the time. And not a lot, to be fair. We have had people bring us in purely for perception. It's the need to be seen that we're doing something without any real care of what that thing is or the outcome is. I think to get people to buy in, again, people need evidence, right? No one does anything without evidence or without an incentive. Every decision we make in life is based on an incentive. So if I'm going to go out tonight and have a ton of beers, it's because I love beer and I'm having a great time. If I'm going to go out tonight and not drink, it's because I'm going to feel better in the morning, right? So everything has that's a bit of a rogue example to use, but everything has an incentive, right? So again, going to your point of how can you change that perception around personal development. There's got to be an incentive. There's got to be evidence. There's got to be, because otherwise, no one changes their mind for no reason. So no one's going to change their perception without something. So what we'd say is actually, it's all hypothetical, I suppose, but if someone's got to go away and do something on their own and then prove the impact it's had and how that actually helps the whole. So I've gone away and I've upskilled myself in this. By me doing that, actually, I've helped my team because I'm now more proficient in this, or I can better help this problem, which then helps the business as a whole. And then you've evidence.
Do you think that's a really interesting point, Will, because Matt and I are working with a recruitment organization in London at the moment, that their CEO, a young guy, and part of the program is that they want the people that are going on this change program, which is all about key account management strategy, they want them to evidence their learnings, play that back to the business. I guess that in itself creates an element of an incentive for, if you're not going to do, a bit of pain, right? Because you're going to turn up to your CEO and not have anything to share. So the element of evidence and stories, again, is an important aspect to change that mindset.
Massively. Yeah, massively. There's nuance, right? You can go into an amazing skit by Michael McIntyre. I'm going to go slightly left and come back. So bear with me. And he talks around this concept of when you go out for dinner. So you go out for dinner and you order a bottle of, sorry, you're going to order wine. So you give him the wine menu. No one knows what the hell any of the wines actually are. All you do is look at prices and make sure you don't choose one that's too expensive. You don't choose one that's too cheap. You tell the waiter has no idea what the wine is. Then they come over and you've got to stop your meal to like stare at a bottle of wine. Then you've got to taste it. And he goes on this whole thing. And essentially what he's talking about is this, like, this bullshit production. It's complete bullshit production. And we only do it because that's what we assume we should do. That's what you do in a restaurant. That's what you do in a restaurant. But he says, why am I tasting the wine to see if it's off? I'm paying for it. You taste the wine, tell me is it off, and if it's off, then serve it to me. Like this complete kind of, the whole coffee at the end, he said, I was at home and my wife came to me at 11:30 at night before bed and said, do you want a coffee? I said, are you mental? No, of course I don't. Why would I want that? And the other night, in a restaurant, 11:30 at night, do you want a coffee? Yeah, I'll have a double espresso. You know, it's crazy, but you do it. And again, when you bring that into the businesses, again, going back to this cohesion element, is how many of our conversations are bullshit productions? So how often are we saying things we think the person wants to hear as opposed to what we actually think? So to your point, Johnny, in terms of evidencing learnings, if I'm in a session, I know what the CEO wants me to say. I know what he wants me to get from this. So I just go and go, cool, yeah, this is what I learned. Brilliant, well done, off you trot. I haven't learned that at all. I've learned squat. And from a performance point of view, I'm much better off going, Johnny, that was rubbish. That was awful. I've learned nothing from this. We need to, because that's when we actually shift the dial and our ability to, okay, cool, so we need to change the training, we need to do whatever. But I go in and say, yeah, it's great. We build this assumption that what we're doing is working. And then lo and behold, a year down the line, it's not working. And then the same person comes back and goes, yeah, you know what? When we ran that course, I actually wasn't that into it. And he goes, why the hell didn't you tell me to begin with? And again, and that whole scenario happens every single day in every single team in numerous different guises, and we've all been in bullshit productions, and we've all been on both sides. We've all received someone that's telling us what we want to hear, and we've all been the one telling someone what they want. Reviews, performance reviews, ultimate bullshit productions. You're only saying what you want the person wants to hear because they're your line manager. They're judging you on your performance. Why would you say otherwise? So how do you create a space where you can say otherwise, right? Where you know you just mean no judgment, there's no opinion coming back on you.
And how do you create that psychological safety, though? I'm curious, how do you create that safety?
This is it takes time. And this is why we go back to the philosophical decision, because this doesn't, you know, this takes a long time to build. So if you use the data in rugby, tells you that you cannot reach a playoff match unless your team have an accumulated 2,000 minutes of playing together, and about 49% of them have come internally through the system. So 2,000 minutes of playing together isn't you've played 1,000, I've played 1,000, therefore we've played 2,000. If you've played 1,000, I've played 1,000, and this is the first game we're playing together, we've played zero. So 2,000 minutes is two seasons. It's 2.5 seasons. As a manager, you're coming in saying, I'm going to build a team that's going to come right in 2 years' time. Very few people are saying, yeah, crack on, Will, have at it. Because we've got fans we've got to please, we've got shareholders. So again, that's why we come back to, you have to dig in and you have to build it. One way of viewing a team, you can buy a team, the best team. The other one's not for sale. You have to build it. And this one, we know from all the research and all the data, is the one that's going to give you the long-term sustainable. But how willing are people to dig into that?
But that also resonates, Matt, and get your point of view, which is some of the lag metrics that we see businesses, you know, going against, which would be regrettable attrition, but actually conversely to that would be the balance of keeping tenure, right? So moving tenure from 11 months a sales development representative to an 18-month process or an account executive, and why you build career pathways. I think it resonates that example that the data is pointing towards. If you're going to get to a playoff, you're going to have to do 2,000 hours. And then for a business to get towards, they're going to have to push that metric, Matt. Would you agree from your point of view of working with businesses?
I think absolutely. This conversation has got drawn out for me is two things. One is, and we talked a bit about this in football, in the football example earlier around, you know, around Chelsea, and plenty of the same happens in business, right? PE fund comes in, 3 years, turn around the business, off we go. And from what you've just said there is that the reality is if you're starting from the ground floor or close to it, that's untenable. That's not going to, you're not going to be able to make that kind of change in a business that you need in that space of time. The other thing I'm thinking of as an alternative perspective for some of our listeners out there who might be thinking about it is flipping this and think about this from a client perspective. I've spent a long time in account management, account development, and you look at those critical clients, you look at the relationships and the teams that you may be working with and the way that you partner with your clients, and actually the importance of having, you know, we talk a lot SBR around that, having client centricity and having all of your internal teams working together. But at the same time, it's about how you work together with your client base and those real strong relationships, those clients that will give you a little bit of leeway when something goes wrong that was outside of your control happens because of those relationships. And I think so often we talk about it in the context of relationships, but essentially what we've debated here today is that really, it's an extension of our own team into our client's team. And it's a team that traverses two organizations that makes for a really effective relationship, which means that both parties get the most out of it.
But if you think about any relationship in your life, the best relationships you have more often than not are with people you've known the longest. If I come in here, Matt, and I ask you to do something that means that you're going to stay at work longer tonight, it means you spend less time with your family, whatever it is, you're going to tell me to do one. If someone you love and you know asks you to do the exact same thing, you'll do it. And the only difference between the two of us is the relationship you have with them compared to the relationship you have with me. Mm. So again, when you bring that into client relations, into internal, whatever it is, the premise applies. It's the same principle. We're saying, actually, we say that the biggest metric, and you can't really measure it, is the biggest thing that enables, and I do inverted commas, but the high performance team, is how many people within that group are prepared to show discretionary effort. So how many people are willing to do more for less or do more for nothing?
Yeah, we agree. Yeah.
And that's it. And the question
that,
is...
But you get that a lot from great leadership and people leadership, right? To your point about, I'm more likely to do something for my wife, my father, not you, Will, but probably more for Matt. That is discretionary effort, isn't it? It's going above and beyond to the point of view. I'm going to just move into a topic that we're trying to crack at the moment, Will, when... We would like your thoughts on it from a people perspective. And it's been hugely popularized across the business at the moment. If you think about a sales funnel, traditionally what you've got is the classic marketing at the top, delivering the demand generation. And imagine this is one of your problem statements that you shared with us at the start. And then what happens is marketing then share that lead and that then the opportunity gets managed through the sales funnel. Right. Yeah, that makes sense. It's two distinct groups, right? Which again, It annoys me that we call it two distinct groups, but it is in business. What we're trying to deal with at the moment is supporting businesses unify those two departments, those two groups. Because at the moment, showing you this image now for the listeners, it's fingers are pointing at each other. It's marketing haven't produced enough leads for us to close and therefore revenue's not being here. Or the marketing leads are dreadful. Or sales aren't closing the leads. It's a lot of pointing fingers and limited cohesion to what you've shared earlier. So that's your problem statement. What would be three things you would do to support that business from the work that you do at 101st or the time that you spent in rugby that would build those two teams together?
Yeah,
to make sure they're more efficient and productive and grow.
So the first thing is you get them in a room and you let them fight it out. That's the first thing you do. So nearly every one of our sessions starts with this kind of what we call cards on the table. So until we actually know what each other think, going back to what we spoke earlier, then it doesn't matter what plan we put in place. It's more than likely not going to work. So we have to know. So marketing have to get out their view on the sales team, have to get out their view. And what you'll find is the reality of there'll be a massive amount of, or massive lack of clarity in what actually the two groups do. And everything will be based on assumptions, everything. So sales will have assumptions as to why marketing aren't producing the right leads or putting the right content out there. Marketing will have massive assumptions as to why the sales team aren't closing. The reality is once they're blown out of the water, what you get is this level of, oh, I didn't realize that was how you operate. So I didn't realize that was a challenge that you guys have to deal with. Or I didn't realize that you have these time constraints on what you're trying to put out, or whatever it is. So what you get is this base level understanding and acceptance of this is the reality of the situation.
Just a quick extension before you go on to point two. You remind me a bit like Wayne Barnes there, refereeing it. But just for the listeners, if they were to do this in their own business, a lightweight version, talk about the construction. Like, yeah, you have your two teams in the room. Do you have a referee or a chairperson?
What do you just quickly usually what we do is, again, we bring in, so the team cohesion talk would be one. Henry's would be really good for this in terms of dealing with change. There's obviously adversity and a challenge here, so how do you deal with that? So you have that contextual storytelling piece up front that frames what we're doing. So that immediately puts everyone on a level, right? We're not demonstrating.
Yeah, especially if Henry was there, it'd be like,
this is it, right? And that's the nice kind of byproduct of doing that. It's actually what you do is you put everyone, we've all heard the same thing. Everyone's on a level to begin with. Then what we do is, I don't know what we're talking numbers-wise, but essentially if you had a room of, let's say, 15, you'd split into small groups and each group would be a cross-section of the two teams. So we're not going a sales table, marketing table, because then you carry on with what exists. You cross-section it and then we frame the conversation. So what we do is we say, okay, let's say the framing questions, everything's hung off the framing question, right? So the framing question for this would be something around how do we improve our conversion from marketing to whatever. That's the thing. So that's a framework question. What we do is have a conversation. Okay, we're in relation to this question, culturally and operationally, what do we keep, what do we change, and what do we add? So what do we do really well at the moment that allows us to do this? What do we do really badly that we need to change to allow us? And what don't we do that we did do would help us?
Nice.
The reason you ask that is a cross-section because of what you bring out indirectly is their views on how we are coaching operationally as a team. So what you'll get is we ask keep first, because if we ask keep last, we never get to it, because the change in ad is just like can of worms, allowing them a bit of a bitch and a bit of a moan. But there'll be good stuff there. That's why you have to. But then what we do is marketing, what I think we should change is actually the fact that I don't think you guys do X, Y, and Z. And the sales thing, are you joking? How the hell do you expect us to be able to do that if you don't do X, Y, and Z? So you bring out these conversations indirectly. So it's not a case of going, right, you tell these what you think. And you tell, because
it's a bit more sensitive.
And so I use the fight it out analogy. It's probably a bit crude, right? It's probably a bit,
You've done the rugby pitch.
It's just structuring these conversations, right? And that's what we need. So point two is, so once you've got that and you've got the cards at the table, it's then actually really getting clarity. Okay, so what are the high ticket items there? So from the conversation we just had, we got the stuff we want to keep. That's great. We need to know that, because when you're trying to change or add anything into a culture or a system, that can only happen if we have this kind of golden thread of consistency that runs behind that, which is the stuff we're already doing really well. So from the change in the ad, it's understanding, okay, so what are the big ticket items? And getting agreement and clarity in that. So our big thing is when we work with teams, we say, if you disagree with something and you don't say anything, you have no leg to stand on after this session to bring it up at all. Because we are agreeing verbally. It might mean that we don't get to the end of the session, but that's fine. Because it's more important that we leave this all being clear of where we're going, rather than just going through this bullshit production and getting to the end of the day having achieved nothing. So that'll be point two. So point one, cards out. Point two, get some real tangible agreed, right, these are things we want to go after. Like, forget, and it just narrows the focus, because there'll be a million things to choose from. What are the really top ticket? What's the priority for us now? So that'll be point two. That would be the second point.
I asked you for three, so
I mean, you did just double check. Oh, rounding, I forgot.
That's why I'm just
done. So the third one is then actually, invariably, these high ticket items, they're high ticket, right? So it'll be these big sweeping statements or these big kind of global, we want to be more collaborative or break down silos. And these phrases are actually completely meaningless because everyone talks about them and no one actually. So what we do, okay, cool, what does that look like tomorrow? So what is that actually from an action and from a behavioral point of view? How do you leave work tomorrow being slightly more collaborative than we only were when you arrived? So what is the tiny action? So again, how we draw that from a story, Henry's has got a great, he talks around his whole little big things, then his shows, little big things, his books. And the premise of that is, he got given an 18-month goal to get out of hospital. So when he said that, okay, cool, what do I need to do to get out of hospital? I need to get in a wheelchair. To get in a wheelchair, I've got to get out of my bed. To get out of my bed, I've got to be able to breathe on my own. To breathe on my own, I've got to get off the ventilator. To get off the ventilator, I've got to be able to do breathing exercises. So an 18-month goal was reduced into a 5-minute breathing exercise every single day. That was it. So the framing is our high-ticket items here. These are our 18-month goals, our 18-month get out of hospital goals. So what are your equivalent 5-minute breathing exercises every day that get you closer to it? And what always happens with these sorts of things is actually by having that, knowing the objective and the ambition, but having that real clarity in what do I do today, almost every time we achieve the thing much quicker than we thought we're going to achieve it, because we're able to adapt, we're able to flex, we're able to move, because we're in the moment and we're looking at it. We're not, if we're thinking too far up here, all our decision-making process is based on that. So we take shortcuts and we make the wrong decisions and we do things for the wrong reasons. Whereas if it's in the moment, cool, I'm just doing this today. And I know that if I do this, I'm moving the dial. So that's a three.
Spot on. And it's great to hear it from, well, one is giving me another perspective, Matt. I know we're trying to crack this conundrum at SBR and we've got propositions that we share with clients, but that narrative, the example, and I love the fact that you bring in real life experiences to back up, to set the tone, basically, depending on who you leverage, it's there for a reason in your speaker toolkit. Yeah. But those three things are real well. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries.
Well, it's been, you shared so much with Johnny and I and with the listeners today, and we thank you for that. A lot of our audience is leaders or aspiring leaders out there in the market. If you were to give them one bit of advice from everything that you shared today, clearly they'd love to go off and give you a call and say, hey, can 100 First come in and help us do this? If you wanted just to leave everyone with one thing to think about, what would that be?
It's a shame, because it was going to be hire us. That was going to be it. Somebody got it, you've taken that one off the table. I think too often in life, and this is a bit deep, so bear with me. I think too often in life, like life just goes on, right? And we never stop and we never reflect on that. And I think in business, and I have to check myself all the time running my own business now and with a growing team, actually, is what I'm doing actually doing what I think it's doing? And I think that's a big thing. And then when we actually go back over it and reflect, it often isn't, because we get swept into this way of operating that is just because everyone else is doing it, or because that's what a post on LinkedIn told me to do, or because of whatever it is. And you don't know what you don't know until someone slaps you across the face and says you didn't know that. And we only operate in a world we know. So I think being able to stop, actually ask yourself those questions, and then go out, to your point, Johnny, in terms of, I suppose you would term it as professional development, is go out and ask questions and try and learn some more stuff. And I think it's really important to challenge yourself and have other people challenge you. So, Johnny, you challenge me. If we never get challenged and stuff, people assume that's a good thing because I must be right. It's an awful thing. So if no one challenges you, your pool of knowledge is getting smaller and smaller by the day, because you only know what you know and you're not learning anything new. So I think that's a big thing. I think leaders in businesses say, if you can't hire us, but yeah, we can have negotiations. But if those that can't, then I think it's just the ability to just challenge yourself on what you're doing and reflect. And if you come up chumps with it, then happy days, then you're on to something. And if you're not, it's then what can I do then? How do I bust this myth and this assumption?
Brilliant. I love that kind of challenging yourself. And if you don't continue to learn, then you're going backwards. And I think it's also, for me, it's looking for those different opportunities. And so often, you know, what you've demonstrated today, Will, is that what's come from a sporting context into a corporate world and how you've made that transition, there are so many similarities that others out there can take from other contexts, being a parent, being working in side gigs or whatever it is that you're doing, like leveraging all of those opportunities as learning opportunities. Thank you for that. And thank you so much for your inspiration, for your insight today. It's been fantastic talking to you. So really appreciate you coming in and talking to us. And
thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you as always.
Thank you, Matt. Cheers, Will. Much appreciated.
Cheers, bud. Thank you.
For more insights, make sure you subscribe. And if you enjoy the journey, don't forget to leave us a review. Your feedback fuels our growth. Until next time, keep up that forward-thinking mindset. Goodbye.